Book 3, Chapter 56, Full Awareness of Breathing. Sometimes the Buddha or one of his senior disciples gave a Dharma talk at the Bhikkhunis monastery. Once a month, the Bhikkhunis also attended Dharma discourses at Jetavana or Eastern Park. One year, thanks to a suggestion made by Venerable Sariputta, the Buddha extended the retreat season an extra month. Sariputta knew that by extending the retreat 1 month, many bhikkhus and bhikkhunis from distant centers would be able to travel to Savatthi for direct teaching from the Buddha after they had concluded the retreats at their own centers. And indeed, many came. Lay patrons Sudatta, Visakha, and Mallika used all the means at their disposal to provide food and dwelling for nearly 3,000 monks and nuns. The Pavarana ceremony, held at the end of each rainy season retreat, fell on the full moon day of the month of Kartika that year, rather than Asuyaja. When the full moon day of Kartika arrived, kumudi flowers were blossoming everywhere. Because the kumudi, a white lotus, always blossomed at the same time each year, the full moon day of Kartika was called Kumudi Day. That evening, the Buddha and his 3,000 disciples sat beneath the radiant full moon. The delicate fragrance of lotus flowers drifted up from the lake. The bhikkhus and bhikkhunis sat silently as the Buddha looked out over the community and praised them for their diligence. The Buddha used this special occasion to deliver the sutra on the full awareness of breathing. Of course, every bhikkhu and bhikkhuni present had been taught the method on the awareness of breathing. But this was the first time that most of them had an opportunity to hear this teaching directly from the Buddha. This was also the first time the Buddha compiled and summarized all his previous teachings on the awareness of breathing. Venerable Ananda listened intently, knowing that this sutra would be an important one to transmit to all the Sangha centers. Bhikkhuni Yasodhara, Rahula's mother, and his sister Bhikkhuni Sundari Nanda were among those assembled. They both had been ordained several years earlier under the guidance of Bhikkhuni Gotami. They practiced in a monastery north of Kapilavatthu founded by Bhikkhuni Gotami. Yasodhara had requested to be ordained just 6 months after her mother-in-law, and after 1 year of practice, she became one of Bhikkhuni Gotami's chief assistants. The Bhikkhunis did their best to attend all the retreat seasons in Savatthi in order to receive direct teaching from the Buddha and his senior disciples. Queen Mallika and Lady Visakha were wholehearted supporters of the nuns. For 2 years, the nuns were given a place in the imperial gardens to stay, but by the third year, they had their own nunnery, thanks to the generous patronage of the Queen and Lady Visakha. Because she was growing old, Bhikkhuni Gotami devoted careful attention to training new leaders among the bhikkhunis, including bhikkhunis Yasodhara, Sela, Vimala, Soma, Mutta, and Nandutara. All of them were present that evening in Eastern Park. Venerable Svasti was introduced to Sister Yasodhara and Sister Sundari Nanda by Venerable Rahula. He was deeply moved to meet them at last. The Buddha delivered the sutra. Bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, the method of the full awareness of breathing, if developed and practiced continuously, will bring great rewards and advantages. It will lead to success in practicing the four establishments of mindfulness and the seven factors of awakening, which will give rise to understanding and liberation. One practices as follows. The first breath. Breathing in a long breath, I know I am breathing in a long breath. Breathing out a long breath, I know I'm breathing out a long breath. The second breath. Breathing in a short breath, I know I'm breathing in a short breath. Breathing out a short breath, I know I'm breathing out a short breath. These two breaths enable you to cut through forgetfulness and unnecessary thinking, at the same time giving rise to mindfulness and enabling you to encounter life in the present moment. Forgetfulness is the absence of mindfulness. Breathing with awareness enables us to return to ourselves and to life. The third breath. Breathing in, I am aware of my whole body. Breathing out, I am aware of my whole body. This breath enables you to contemplate the body and be in direct contact with your own body. Awareness of the whole body and awareness of every part of the body allows you to see the wondrous presence of your body and the process of birth and death unfolding in your body. The fourth breath. I am breathing in and making my whole body calm and at peace. I am breathing out and making my whole body calm and at peace. This breath helps you realize calmness and peace in the body and arrive at a state in which mind, body, and breath are one harmonious reality. The fifth breath. I am breathing in and feeling joyful. I am breathing out and feeling joyful. The sixth breath. I am breathing in and feeling happy. I am breathing out and feeling happy. With these two breaths, you cross into the domain of feelings. These two breaths create peace and joy that can nourish mind and body. Thanks to the cessation of dispersion and forgetfulness, you return to yourself, aware of the present moment. Happiness and joy arise within you. You dwell in the wonders of life, able to taste the peace and joy mindfulness brings. Thanks to this encounter with the wonders of life, you are able to transform neutral feelings into pleasant feelings. These two breaths thus lead to pleasant feelings. The seventh breath. I am breathing in and am aware of the activities of the mind in me. I am breathing out and am aware of the activities of the mind in me. The eighth breath. I am breathing in and making the activities of the mind in me calm and at peace. I am breathing out and making the activities of the mind in me calm and at peace. These two breaths enable you to look deeply at all the feelings arising within you, whether they are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and enable you to make those feelings calm and at peace. The activities of the mind mean, in this case, the feelings. When you are aware of your feelings and can see deeply into their roots and nature, you can control them and make them calm and at peace, even though they may be unpleasant thoughts, which arise from desire, anger, and jealousy. The ninth breath. I am breathing in and am aware of my mind. I am breathing out and am aware of my mind. The tenth breath. I am breathing in and making my mind happy and at peace. I am breathing out and making my mind happy and at peace. The 11th breath. I am breathing in and concentrating my mind. I am breathing out and concentrating my mind. The 12th breath. I am breathing in and liberating my mind. I am breathing out and liberating my mind. With these four breaths, you cross into the third domain, which is the mind. The 9th breath enables you to recognize all the states of the mind, such as perceptions, thinking, discrimination, happiness, sadness, and doubt. You observe and recognize these states in order to see deeply into the mind's activities. When the mind's activities are observed and recognized, you are able to concentrate your mind, making it quiet and at peace. This is brought about by the 10th and 11th breaths. The 12th breath enables you to release all obstacles of the mind. Thanks to illuminating your mind, you can see the roots of all mental formations and thus overcome all obstacles. The 13th breath. I am breathing in and observing the impermanent nature of all dharmas. I am breathing out and observing the impermanent nature of all dharmas. The 14th breath. I am breathing in and observing the fading of all dharmas. I am breathing out and observing the fading of all dharmas. The 15th breath. I am breathing in and contemplating liberation. I am breathing out and contemplating liberation. The 16th breath. I am breathing in and contemplating letting go. I am breathing out and contemplating letting go. With these four breaths, the practitioner passes into the domain of objects of the mind and concentrates the mind in order to observe the true nature of all dharmas. First is the observation of the impermanent nature of all dharmas. Because all dharmas are impermanent, they must all fade. When you clearly understand the impermanent and fading nature of all dharmas, you are no longer bound by the endless cycle of birth and death. Thanks to that, you can let go and attain liberation. Letting go does not mean to disdain or run away from life. Letting go means letting go of craving and clinging so you do not suffer from the endless cycle of birth and death to which all dharmas are subject. Once you have let go and attained liberation, you can live in peace and joy in the very midst of life. There is no longer anything that can bind you. So taught the Buddha how to observe deeply the body, feelings, mind, and objects of mind through the 16 methods of conscious breathing. He also applied the 16 exercises to the practice of the 7 factors of awakening, which are full attention, investigating dharmas, energy, joy, ease, concentration, and letting go. Venerable Swasti had already heard the sutra on the four establishments of mindfulness. He now felt that, thanks to this sutra on the full awareness of breathing, he could more deeply penetrate the four establishments. He saw how these two sutras complemented one another, and how fundamental they both were to the practice of meditation. 3,000 bhikkhus and bhikkhunis joyously received the Buddha's teaching that night beneath the light of the full moon. Swasti's heart filled with gratitude to Venerable Sariputta for having made this night possible. One day, Venerable Ahimsaka returned from begging, covered with blood, barely able to walk. Swasti ran to help him. Ahimsaka asked to be taken to the Buddha. He explained that while he was out begging in the city, some people recognized him as the former Angulimala. They cornered him and began to beat him. Ahimsaka did not resist their blows, but joined his hands to form a lotus boat while allowing them to vent their anger and hatred. They battered him until he was vomiting blood. When the Buddha saw that Ahimsaka was hurt, he called to Ananda to get a basin of water and a towel to wash away the blood. He asked Swasti to gather medicinal leaves to make into poultices to place on Ahimsaka's wounds. Although he was in great pain, Venerable Ahimsaka did not cry out. The Buddha said, "Your sufferings today can rinse away all the sufferings of the past. Enduring suffering in love and awareness can erase the bitter hatred of 1,000 lifetimes. Ahimsaka, your robe has been torn to shreds. Where is your bowl?" "Lord, they shattered it. I will ask Ananda to find you a new robe and bowl." As Swasti applied poultices to Ahimsaka's wounds, he realized what an example of nonviolence Ahimsaka was. Venerable Ahimsaka told Swasti a story that had taken place only the day before when he was out begging. Beneath a tree in the forest, Ahimsaka encountered a woman in labor. She was in extreme pain and unable to give birth to the child. Ahimsaka cried out, "Such terrible pain!" and ran to ask the Buddha what could be done. The Buddha said, "Run back to her and tell her, 'Madam, from the day I was born, I have never intentionally harmed any living being. By that merit, may you and your child be peaceful and safe.'" Ahimsaka protested, "I would be lying if I said such a thing. The truth is, I have harmed a great many living beings." The Buddha said, "Then go and tell her, 'Madam, since the day I was born in the noble Dharma, I have never intentionally harmed any living being. By that merit, may you and your child be peaceful and safe.'" Ahimsaka ran back to the forest and spoke those words. Within a few minutes, the woman safely gave birth to her child. Venerable Ahimsaka had traveled far along the path, earning the Buddha's highest praises. Chapter 57. The Raft is Not the Shore. That winter, the Buddha stayed in Vesali. One day, while he was meditating not far from Kutagarasala Dharma Hall, several bhikkhus committed suicide in another part of the monastery. When the Buddha was informed, he asked what led them to kill themselves. He was told that after meditating on the impermanent and fading nature of the body, these bhikkhus expressed aversion for the body and no longer wished to live. The Buddha was saddened to hear this. He called all the remaining bhikkhus together. He said, "Bhikkhus, we meditate on impermanence and fading in order to see into the true nature of all dharmas, so that we will not be bound by them. Enlightenment and freedom cannot be attained by escaping the world. They can only be attained when one sees deeply into the true nature of all dharmas. These brothers did not understand, and so they foolishly sought to escape. By doing so, they violated the precept against killing. Bhikkhus, a liberated person neither clings to dharmas nor feels aversion to them. Clinging and aversion are both ropes that bind. A free person transcends both in order to dwell in peace and happiness. Such happiness cannot be measured. A free person does not cling to narrow views about permanence and a separate self, nor does he cling to narrow views about impermanence and non-self. Bhikkhus, study and practice the teaching intelligently in a spirit of non-attachment." And the Buddha taught the bhikkhus the practice of conscious breathing to help them refresh themselves. When he returned to Savatthi, the Buddha gave further teaching on breaking through attachment in response to a bhikkhu named Arita, who was bound to narrow views because he also misunderstood the teaching. Sitting before the bhikkhus at Jetavana, the Buddha said, "Bhikkhus, if the teaching is misunderstood, it is possible to become caught in narrow views, which will create suffering for oneself and others. You must listen to, understand, and apply the teaching in an intelligent manner. Someone who understands snakes uses a forked stick to pin down a snake's neck before trying to pick it up. If he picks up the snake by the tail or body, the snake can easily bite him. Just as you would use your intelligence in catching a snake, you should use it to study the teaching. Bhikkhus, the teaching is merely a vehicle to describe the truth. Don't mistake it for the truth itself. A finger pointing at the moon is not the moon. The finger is needed to know where to look for the moon. But if you mistake the finger for the moon itself, you will never know the real moon. The teaching is like a raft that carries you to the other shore. The raft is needed, but the raft is not the other shore. An intelligent person would not carry the raft around on his head after making it across to the other shore. Bhikkhus, my teaching is the raft, which can help you cross to the other shore beyond birth and death. Use the raft to cross to the other shore, but don't hang on to it as your property. Do not become caught in the teaching. You must be able to let it go. Bhikkhus, all the teaching I have given you, such as the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Four Establishments of Mindfulness, the Seven Factors of Awakening, Impermanence, Non-Self, Suffering, Emptiness, Signlessness, and Aimlessness, should be studied in an intelligent, open manner. Use the teachings to help you reach liberation. Do not become attached to them. The monastery for bhikkhunis housed 500 nuns. They frequently invited the Buddha and other venerables from Jetavana to come and give them Dharma talks. Venerable Ananda was asked by the Buddha to be in charge of selecting which monks should go to deliver Dharma talks to the bhikkhunis. One day he assigned Venerable Banda to go. Venerable Banda had attained deep fruits in his practice, but he was not noted for his speaking talent. The following day, after begging and eating his meal alone in the forest, he went to the bhikkhuni center. The sisters warmly received him, and Bhikkhuni Gotami invited him to sit on the pedestal to give his Dharma talk. After settling on his cushion, he recited a short poem. Dwelling in tranquility, seeing the Dharma, returning to the source without hatred or violence, joy and peace overflow. Mindfulness is held perfectly. True peace and ease are realized. Transcending all desires is the greatest happiness. The Venerable said no more, but proceeded to enter into a state of deep concentration. Though his words had been few, his presence radiated peace and happiness, which most of the sisters found greatly encouraging. Some of the younger sisters, however, were disappointed by how short his talk was. They urged Bhikkhuni Gotami to ask if he might say something more. Bhikkhuni Gotami bowed to Venerable Banda and expressed the wish of the younger sisters. But Venerable Banda simply repeated the same poem again, and then stepped down from the pedestal. Some days later, the Buddha was told about Venerable Banda's Dharma talk. It was suggested to the Buddha that, in the future, monks more talented at speaking should give the Dharma talks. But the Buddha replied that a person's presence was more important than his words. One morning, after returning from his begging, the Buddha was unable to find Ananda. Venerable Rahula and others said they had not seen him. Then one bhikkhu reported that he had seen Ananda go begging in a nearby village of untouchables. The Buddha asked that bhikkhu to go to the village and look for Ananda. The bhikkhu found Ananda and returned with him to the monastery. He also brought back two women, a mother and her daughter, whose name was Prakriti. The Buddha listened to Ananda explain how he had been delayed that day. One day, several weeks before, on his way back to the monastery after begging, Ananda suddenly felt thirsty. He stopped by the well in the untouchable village for a drink. There he found Prakriti lifting a bucket of water from the well. She was a beautiful young woman. Ananda asked her for a drink of water, but she refused. She told him she was an untouchable and did not dare pollute a monk by offering him water. Ananda told her, "I do not need high rank or caste. I only need a drink of water. I would be happy to receive it from you. Please don't be afraid of polluting me." Prakriti offered him water at once. She felt drawn to this kind and handsome monk who spoke so gently. She was smitten with love. At night she could not sleep. All her thoughts were of Ananda. She waited by the well every day after that in hopes of catching a glimpse of him. She persuaded her mother to invite him to share a meal in their home. He accepted twice, but sensing that the young woman had fallen in love with him, he refused additional invitations. Prakriti was lovesick. She grew thin and pale. Finally, she confessed her feelings to her mother. She said she wanted Ananda to renounce his vows and marry her. Her shocked mother shouted at her and told her it was a foolish and impossible love. But Prakriti said she would sooner die than give up Ananda. Fearing for her daughter's death, Prakriti's mother prepared an aphrodisiac in hopes she might get Ananda to respond to her daughter's passion. She was from the Matanga clan and knew a number of shamanistic potions. That morning, Prakriti met Ananda on the street and implored him to accept one last invitation to eat at their home. Ananda was confident he could offer Prakriti and her mother teaching that would enable Prakriti to let go of her desire for him. But he had no chance to teach anything before he drank the tainted tea. His head began to swim and his limbs went weak. At once what had happened, and he turned to his breathing to counteract the effects of the herbs. The bhikkhu sent by the Buddha found him in Prakriti's hut, sitting perfectly still in the lotus position. The Buddha gently asked Prakriti, "You love Bhikkhu Ananda deeply, don't you?" Prakriti answered, "I love him with all my heart." "What is it you love about him? Is it his eyes, his nose, or perhaps his mouth?" "I love everything about him. His eyes, his nose, his mouth, his voice, the way he walks. Master, I love everything about him." Besides his eyes, nose, mouth, voice, and walk, Bhikkhu Ananda possesses many beautiful qualities, which you do not know yet. "What qualities are those?" asked Prakriti. The Buddha answered, "His heart of love is one." "Do you know what Bhikkhu Ananda loves?" "Sir, I do not know what he loves. I only know that he doesn't love me." "You are mistaken. Bhikkhu Ananda does love you, but not in the way you desire. Bhikkhu Ananda loves the path of liberation, freedom, peace, and joy. Thanks to the liberation and freedom he experiences, Bhikkhu Ananda often smiles. He loves all other beings. He wants to bring the path of liberation to all others so that they too may enjoy freedom, peace, and joy." "Prakriti, Bhikkhu Ananda's love comes from understanding and liberation. He does not suffer or feel hopeless because of his love, unlike the way your love makes you feel. If you truly love Bhikkhu Ananda, you will understand his love, and you will allow him to continue living the life of liberation he has chosen. If you knew how to love in the way Bhikkhu Ananda does, you would no longer suffer and feel hopeless. Your suffering and hopelessness result from your wanting Bhikkhu Ananda all to yourself. That is a selfish kind of love." Prakriti looked at the Buddha and asked, "But how can I love in the way that Bhikkhu Ananda loves?" "Love in a way that will preserve the happiness of Bhikkhu Ananda as well as your own happiness. Bhikkhu Ananda is like a fresh breeze. If you catch a breeze and trap it in a prison of love, the breeze will soon die, and no one will be able to benefit from its coolness, including yourself. Love Ananda as you would a refreshing breeze. Prakriti, if you could love like that, you could become a cool, refreshing breeze yourself. You would relieve your own pains and burdens and those of many others as well. Please, Master, teach me how to love in such a way." "You can choose the same path as Bhikkhu Ananda. You can live a life of liberation, peace, and joy, bringing happiness to others just as Bhikkhu Ananda does. You could be ordained just as he is." "But I am an untouchable. How can I be ordained?" "We have no caste in our Sangha. Several untouchable men have already been ordained as bhikkhus. Venerable Sunita, so highly regarded by King Pasenadi, was an untouchable. If you wanted to become a bhikkhuni, you would be the first nun to come from the untouchables. If you want, I will ask Sister Kema to perform an ordination ceremony for you." Overcome with joy, Prakriti prostrated herself before the Buddha and asked to be ordained. The Buddha gave Prakriti into Sister Kema's care. After the nun and young woman departed, the Buddha looked at Ananda and then spoke to the entire community. "Bhikkhus, Ananda's vows are still intact, but I want all of you to be more careful in your outside relations. If you dwell continuously in mindfulness, you will see what is taking place both within and without you. Detecting something early on will enable you to deal effectively with it. By practicing mindfulness every moment of your daily life, you will be able to develop the concentration needed to avoid situations such as this. When your concentration is strong and stable, your vision will be clear and your actions timely. Concentration and understanding go hand in hand with each other. Each contains the other. They are one. Bhikkhus, regard women older than yourself as your mother or elder sister. Regard women younger than yourself as your younger sister or daughter. Do not let your attractions create difficulties for your practice. If necessary, until your concentration is stronger, limit your contacts with women. Speak only words that relate to the study and practice of the way. The bhikkhus were happy to receive the Buddha's guidance. Chapter 58. A Handful of Precious Dirt. One day, while begging in a poor hamlet, the Buddha met some children playing on a dirt path. They were building a city from dirt and sand, complete with a city wall, storehouse, dwellings, and even a river. When the children saw the Buddha and bhikkhus approaching, one child said to the others, "The Buddha and bhikkhus are traveling past our city. It is only proper for us to make an offering to them." The other children liked the idea, but said, "What do we have to offer the Buddha? We're only children." The first child answered, "Listen, my friends, there are great reserves of harvested rice in the storehouse of our city of dirt and sand. We can offer some of it to the Buddha." The other children clapped their hands in delight. They dug out a handful of dirt from their storehouse, and pretending it was rice, placed it on a leaf. The first child lifted the leaf in his two hands and respectfully knelt before the Buddha. The other children knelt beside him. He said, "The people of our city respectfully offer this rice from our storehouse. We pray you will accept it." The Buddha smiled. He patted the boy on the head and said, "Thank you, children, for offering this precious rice to us. You are most thoughtful." The Buddha turned to Ananda and said, "Ananda, please take this offering, and as soon as we return to the monastery, we can mix it with water and daub it on the earthen bricks of my hut." Ananda took the handful of earth. The children invited the Buddha to sit with them on a large rock beneath a nearby banyan tree. Ananda and the other bhikkhus gathered around too. The Buddha told the children a story. Many lives ago, there lived a prince named Visvantara. He was a very generous and kind-hearted man. He always shared with the poor and needy, never hesitating to part with anything he owned. His wife, Madri, was equally generous. She knew how much pleasure it gave her husband to help others, and she never expressed any regret about the things he gave away. They had a son named Jalin and a daughter named Krishnajina. During a famine, Prince Visvantara asked his father's permission to distribute rice and cloth from the imperial stores to the poor. The king consented. So great was the people's need that the stores were nearly exhausted. This caused alarm to a number of imperial advisors. They wanted to devise a scheme that would prevent the prince from giving any more away. First, they told the king that the prince's indiscriminate giving would be the ruin of the kingdom. They revealed that the prince had given away one of the treasured imperial elephants. At this, even the king grew alarmed. He allowed his ministers to talk him into banishing his only son to the remote mountains of Jayapura, where the prince would experience firsthand the hardships of a simple life. Thus, Visvantara, Madri, and the two children were sent into exile. On their journey to the mountains, they met a poor beggar. The prince removed his fine jacket and gave it to the man. When they encountered more poor people, Madri removed her own fine jacket and gave it to them. Before long, Jalin and Krishnajina had given away their jackets as well. The family also gave away their jewels and ornaments to needy people along the route. Before they reached the mountains, they had given away everything they owned that could be traded for food. At last, the prince gave away even their carriage and two horses. The prince carried Jalin, and Madri lifted Krishnajina into her arms. Without regrets, they walked until they reached Jayapura. They walked and sang as though they didn't have a care in the world. Their hearts felt light and free. It was a long trek, and Visvantara and Madri's feet were swollen and bloody by the time they made it to the remote mountains. They were lucky to find an abandoned hut on the mountain slope. The hut had once belonged to a hermit. They swept and tidied the hut and gathered leafy branches to make beds. In the forest, they found an ample supply of wild fruits and greens to eat. The children learned how to gather food, wash clothes in a mountain spring, sow seeds, and tend a garden. The prince and his wife taught the children how to read and write, using large leaves for paper and thorns for pens. Though their life was difficult, they were content. For 3 years they lived in peace. But then one day, when Prince Visvantara and Madri were out gathering fruit deep in the forest, a stranger came and kidnapped the children. The prince and his wife searched for many days throughout the forest and in nearby villages, but they could not find a trace of their beloved children. Finally, exhausted and discouraged, they returned to their hut, hoping against hope that the children might have returned there on their own. Instead, they were surprised to meet one of the king's messengers waiting for them. They were greatly relieved when he informed them that Jalin and Krishnajina were safe at the palace with the king. When they asked how the children came to be there, the messenger explained, "Several days ago, one of the palace ladies saw the children being sold at a market in the capital. She recognized them as your children, and she quickly returned to the palace to inform her husband, a royal advisor. He ran to the market and told the merchant to take the children to the palace, where he could be assured of receiving a handsome price for them. The king recognized his grandchildren, even with their tattered clothes and soiled faces. He realized how deeply he missed you and your family." The king asked, "Where did you find these children? How much are you selling them for?" Before the merchant could respond, the royal advisor spoke. "Your Majesty, the girl is being sold for 1,000 pounds of gold and 1,000 cattle. The price for the boy is 100 pounds and 100 cattle." Everyone, including the merchant and children, were surprised to hear these words. The king asked, "Why is the girl so much more than the boy?" The royal advisor replied, "You clearly value girls more than boys. You never scold or punish the princesses for any indulgences. Even the palace servant girls are treated with kindness and respect by you. You have only one son, yet you exiled him to a remote mountain region where tigers and leopards roam and where there is nothing but wild fruit to eat. Surely you value girls more than boys." The king was moved to tears. "Please say no more. I understand your meaning." The king learned from the merchant that he had bought the children from another man in the mountains. The king paid the merchant and then ordered him to lead the imperial police to the kidnapper. The king embraced his two grandchildren and asked them about their life in the mountains. He issued orders for his son and daughter-in-law to be allowed to return to the capital. From then on, the king cherished his son and generously assisted in the son's efforts to relieve the suffering of the poor. The children liked the Buddha's story very much. The Buddha smiled at them and said, "Prince Visvantara was happy to share all he owned with others. Today you shared a handful of precious earth from your city's storehouse with me. You have made me very happy. You can make others happy by offering them some small gift each day. It doesn't have to be something you buy. When you pick a flower by the rice fields and offer it to your parents, you make them happy. A word of thanks or love can also be a precious gift. A kind look or a small gesture of caring brings happiness to others. Offer such gifts every day to your family and friends. The bhikkhus and I must go now, but we will always remember the fine offering you made today." The children promised they would invite more friends and go visit the Buddha and bhikkhus at Jetavana. They wanted to hear more stories. The next summer, the Buddha returned to Rajagaha to teach. Afterward, he went to Vulture Peak. Jivaka paid him a visit and invited him to spend a few days at the mango grove. The Buddha accepted the invitation, and Ananda joined him. The physician's mango grove was cool and refreshing. The trees were in their eighth year of bearing fruit. Jivaka readied a small hut for the Buddha and prepared vegetarian dishes for him every day. He suggested that the Buddha rest from begging for a few days in order to rebuild his strength. He also prepared an herbal tonic for the Buddha, made from roots, leaves, and fruits. One day as they sat together, Jivaka said, "Lord, some people say you let the bhikkhus eat meat. They claim that Gautama tolerates the killing of animals to feed himself and his students. Some even make wild accusations that Gautama requires people to offer meat to the Sangha. I know these things are not true, but I would appreciate your thoughts on these matters." The Buddha replied, "Jivaka, people do not speak the truth when they say I allow animals to be killed to provide food for myself and the bhikkhus. I have in fact spoken on this matter a number of times. If a bhikkhu sees someone killing an animal for the purposes of offering it as food to the bhikkhu must refuse it. Even if he doesn't actually see the animal being killed, but is told it was killed on his behalf, he must refuse it. Furthermore, if he merely suspects it may have been killed on his behalf, he must refuse it. Niraka, according to the practice of begging, a bhikkhu accepts whatever is offered unless an animal has been killed on the bhikkhu's behalf. People who understand the bhikkhu's vows of compassion offer only vegetarian food to the monks. But sometimes a person only has food that has been prepared with meat. Also, persons who have not had previous contact with the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha do not know that the bhikkhus prefer vegetarian food. In such situations, the bhikkhu accepts whatever is offered to avoid offending the giver and to create an opportunity for contact so that the person may learn about the path of liberation. Jivaka, someday all the people will understand that bhikkhus do not want animals to be killed. At that time, no one will offer meat to the bhikkhus, and the bhikkhus will be able to eat only vegetarian food. Jivaka said, I believe that a vegetarian diet promotes better health. One feels lighter and is less prone to illness. I've been a vegetarian for 10 years now. It is good for the health and for nurturing a heart of compassion. I am happy, Lord, for receiving your clear teaching about this. Jivaka also commended the Sangha's practice of being careful not to eat food left over from the previous day. Food kept overnight could spoil and cause illness. The Buddha thanked Jivaka and invited him to come to the monastery to speak to the monks again about basic sanitary practices. Chapter 59. The Net of Theories. Jivaka's mango grove was tranquil and spacious. Scattered throughout the orchard were small huts for the bhikkhunis. One evening, a young bhikkhuni named Subha came to discuss a problem with the Buddha. She had completed her begging and was returning to the mango grove by way of a deserted street, when suddenly a young man appeared and stood in her way. She sensed his dishonorable intentions and began to observe her breath in order to remain calm and clear-headed. She looked directly into his eyes and said, Sir, I am a nun who follows the way of the Buddha. Please move out of my way so that I may return to my nunnery. The man said, You are still young and very pretty. Why waste your life by shaving your head and wearing yellow robes? Why live like an ascetic? Listen, miss, your lovely body should be clad in a silk sari from Kasi. Why, I've never seen a woman as pretty as you. Let me show you the pleasures of the body. Come with me. Subha remained calm. Don't speak foolishly. I seek my happiness in a life of liberation and enlightenment. The 5 categories of desire only lead to suffering. Allow me to pass. I will be grateful for your understanding. But the man refused. Your eyes are so beautiful. I've never seen such beautiful eyes. Don't think I'm foolish enough to let you go. You will come with me. He reached out to grab her, but Subha stepped out of reach and said, Sir, do not touch me. You must not violate a nun. Because I was weary of a life burdened with craving and hatred, I chose the life of spiritual practice. You say my eyes are beautiful. Very well, I will pluck them out and give them to you. Better to be blind than violated by you. Subha's voice was full of determination. The man flinched. He knew she was capable of doing what she said. He stepped back. Subha continued, Don't let your desires cause you to commit crimes. Don't you know that King Bimbisara has issued a decree that anyone who harms a member of the Buddha Sangha will be dealt with severely? If you do not behave properly, if you threaten my chastity or my life, you will be arrested and punished. Suddenly the young man came to his senses. He saw how blind passion can lead to suffering. He stepped out of the nun's way to let her pass. He called after her. Please forgive me, sister. I hope you attain your goal on the spiritual path. Subha walked on without looking back. The Buddha praised the young nun for her courage and clarity. He said, It is dangerous for nuns to walk alone on deserted paths. That is one of the reasons I hesitated initially to ordain women. Subha, from now on, no bhikkhuni should travel alone. Whether crossing a river, entering a village to beg, or walking through a forest or a field, no bhikkhuni should walk alone. No bhikkhuni should sleep alone either. Whether she sleeps in a nunnery, a small hut, or beneath a tree, no bhikkhuni should sleep by herself. She should always travel and sleep with at least one other bhikkhuni so they can watch out for each other and protect each other. The Buddha turned to Ananda and instructed him. Ananda, please make careful note of this new rule. Request all the bhikkhuni elders to place this rule in their precepts. When the Buddha departed from Jivaka's mango grove, he went to Nalanda, accompanied by a large number of bhikkhus. They all walked slowly and mindfully. Each bhikkhu observed his breath. Behind the bhikkhus traveled two ascetics, Supiyu and his disciple Brahmadatta. They spoke in loud voices about the Buddha and his teaching. Supiyu criticized and ridiculed the Buddha. Oddly enough, his disciple countered his statements by commending the Buddha and his teaching. The disciple spoke eloquently and convincingly to his teacher, moving the bhikkhus who could not help but hear the conversation going on behind them. That evening, the bhikkhus stopped to rest in Ambalatika, a lush forest that belonged to the royal family. King Bimbisara allowed all spiritual seekers from all sects to stop at Ambalatika whenever they needed rest. Supiyu and Brahmadatta stopped the night there. The next morning, the bhikkhus discussed among themselves the conversation between the two ascetics. The Buddha heard them and said, "Bhikkhus, whenever you hear someone criticize or ridicule me or the Dharma, do not give rise to feelings of anger, irritation, or indignation. Such feelings can only harm yourselves. Whenever you hear someone praise me or the Dharma, do not give rise to feelings of happiness, pleasure, or satisfaction. That, too, will only harm you. The correct attitude is to examine the criticism to see what parts may be true and what parts are not true. Only by doing that will you have a chance to further your studies and make real progress. Because most people who praise the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha possess only superficial understanding. They appreciate how the bhikkhus lead chaste, simple, and serene lives, but they do not see beyond that. Those who have grasped the most subtle and profound depths of the Dharma speak few words of praise. They understand the true wisdom of enlightenment. Such wisdom is profound, sublime, and marvelous. It transcends all ordinary thoughts and words. Because there are countless philosophies, doctrines, and theories in this world. People criticize each other and argue for their theories. According to my investigation, there are 62 main theories that underlie the thousands of philosophies and religious currents in our world. Looked at from the way of enlightenment and emancipation, all 62 of these theories contain errors and create obstacles. The Buddha proceeded to explain the 62 theories and expose their errors. He spoke on the 18 theories concerning the past, 4 theories of eternalism, 4 theories of partial eternalism, 4 theories on the finitude and infinity of the world, 4 theories of endless equivocation, and 2 theories that claim that causality does not exist. He spoke about the 44 theories that concern the future, 16 that allege the soul lives on after death, 8 that say there is no soul after death, 8 that posit there is neither a soul that continues after death nor ceases to continue after death, 7 nihilistic theories, and 5 theories that say that the present is already nirvana. After exposing all the errors contained in these theories, the Buddha said, "A good fisherman places his net in the water and catches all the shrimp and fish he can. As he watches the creatures try to leap out of the net, he tells them, 'No matter how high you jump, you will only land in the net again.' He is correct. The thousands of beliefs flourishing at present can all be found in the net of these 62 theories. Bhikkhus, don't fall into that bewitching net. You will only waste time and lose your chance to practice the way of enlightenment. Don't fall into the net of mere speculation. Bhikkhus, all these beliefs and doctrines have arisen because people have been led astray by their perceptions and feelings. When mindfulness is not practiced, it is impossible to see the true nature of perceptions and feelings. When you can penetrate the roots and see into the true nature of your perceptions and feelings, you will see the impermanent and interdependent nature of all dharmas. You will no longer be caught in the net of desire, anxiety, and fear, or the net of the 62 false theories." After the Dharma talk, Venerable Ananda took a walk and focused his attention on recalling every word the Buddha spoke. He thought, "This is an important sutra. I will call it the Brahmajala Sutra, the Sutra of the Great Net. This net collects all the false theories and dogmas of this world. Chapter 60. Lady Visakha's Grief. After Malatika, the Buddha went to teach in Nalanda, and then to Kampa, a large city in the state of Anga. Anga was a populous and fertile region under the jurisdiction of King Bimbisara. There the Buddha dwelled in a cool forest by Gagara Lake, where many fragrant lotus flowers grew. People came in great numbers to listen to the Buddha teach. A young wealthy Brahmin named Sonadanda also came to meet the Buddha. Sonadanda was known and admired in the region for his astute intelligence. Several of his friends discouraged him from paying a visit to the Buddha. They felt a visit by Sonadanda would grant too much prestige to the monk Gautama. Sonadanda smiled and said that he did not want to pass up an opportunity to meet a man like the Buddha, who was known to possess uncommon insight. Such a chance only presented itself once in 1,000 years, he said. I must go to deepen my own knowledge, said Sonadanda. I want to see in which areas monk Gautama exceeds me and in which areas I exceed monk Gautama. Several hundred Brahmins decided to join Sonadanda. They walked to Gagara Lake, placing their faith in Sonadanda. They were sure he would show the teaching of their caste to be superior to that of the Buddha. They knew Sonadanda would not bring shame to the Brahmins. When Sonadanda stood before the Buddha, who was already surrounded by dense crowds, he faltered for a moment, not knowing how to begin. The Buddha assisted him by speaking first. He said, Sonadanda, can you tell us what characteristics are essential to be a true Brahmin? If necessary, please cite the Vedas as evidence. Sonadanda was pleased. The Vedas were his particular field of specialty. He said, Monk Gautama, an authentic Brahmin possesses 5 characteristics. An attractive appearance, skill in chanting and performing rituals, purity of blood that can be traced back 7 generations, virtuous action, and wisdom. The Buddha asked, of these 5 characteristics, which are the most essential? Can one still be a true Brahmin if any of the characteristics are absent? Sonadanda reflected and responded that the last 2 characteristics were the only ones truly indispensable. Physical beauty, skill in chanting and performing rituals, and purity of blood were not absolutely essential. Hearing Sonadanda say this disturbed the 500 Brahmins that had accompanied him. They all stood and shook their arms to challenge Sonadanda's statements. They felt he had been swayed by the Buddha's questioning, and that his responses were an embarrassment to their caste. The Buddha turned to them and said, Honored guests, if you have faith in Sonadanda, please be quiet and allow him to continue speaking with me. If you no longer have faith in him, ask him to sit down, and I will speak with any one of you instead. Everyone fell silent. Sonadanda looked at the Buddha and said, Monk Gautama, please allow me to address a few words to my friends. Sonadanda turned to his fellows and pointed to a young man sitting in the front row of their ranks. He said, Do you see my cousin Angaka there? Angaka is a handsome and elegant youth. His demeanor is refined and noble. Few except Monk Gautama can compete with his handsome looks. Angaka is also well-versed in the Vedas. He possesses skill in chanting and performing rituals. He can claim purity of blood traced back 7 generations on both sides of his family. No one can deny that he possesses these 3 characteristics. But let us suppose that Angaka was a drunkard who murdered, robbed, raped, and lied. Of what value would his attractive looks, chanting skills, and purity of blood be then? Dear friends, we must admit that virtuous action and wisdom are the only 2 characteristics truly essential to be a true Brahmin. This is a truth for all, not just a private truth for Monk Gautama. The crowds applauded with approval. When the applause died down, the Buddha asked Sonadanda, Of these 2 characteristics, virtuous action and wisdom, is one more essential than the other? Sonadanda answered, Monk Gautama, virtuous action develops from wisdom, and wisdom increases thanks to virtuous action. They cannot be separated. It is like using one hand to wash the other, or using one foot to scratch the other. Virtuous action and wisdom assist and nurture each other. Virtuous action enables wisdom to shine forth. Wisdom enables action to grow ever more virtuous. These 2 qualities are the most precious things in life. The Buddha responded, Excellent, Sonadanda. You speak the truth. Virtuous action and wisdom are the two most precious things in life. Can you tell us more? How can one develop virtuous action and wisdom to the highest degree? Sonadanda smiled and joined his palms. He bowed to the Buddha and said, Master, please guide us. We know the principles, but you are the one who has actually attained the true path. Please tell us how to develop virtuous action and wisdom to the highest degree. The Buddha spoke to them about the path of liberation. He told them of the three steps to enlightenment: precepts, concentration, and understanding. Observing the precepts develops concentration. Concentration leads to understanding. Understanding enables one to practice the precepts more deeply. The more deeply the precepts are observed, the greater one's concentration grows. The greater one's concentration, the deeper one's understanding. The Buddha also spoke about meditating on dependent co-arising in order to break through false concepts of permanence and a separate self. Meditating on dependent co-arising enables one to cut the bonds of greed, anger, and ignorance in order to attain liberation, peace, and joy. Sonadanda listened spellbound. When the Buddha was finished, Sonadanda stood up and joined his palms. He said, Master Gautama, please accept my gratitude. You have opened my eyes today. You have led me out of the darkness. Please allow me to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. I would also like to invite you and all the bhikkhus to my home tomorrow for a meal offering. The enthusiastic exchange that took place that day between the Buddha and young Sonadanda sent waves throughout all levels of society in the region. A large number of Brahmana intellectuals became disciples of the Buddha in the village of Ikalankala, including a well-known Brahmin named Ambata and his teacher Pokarasadi. As more and more young Brahmins became disciples of the Buddha, it became difficult to quell the jealousy and resentment of certain Brahmana leaders and leaders of other religious sects. While they were still staying in Ambalatika, Sasti asked Venerable Moggallana about the different religious movements of the times. Moggallana summarized the main tenets of each sect for him. First of all, there was the sect of Puranakasapa. His followers were skeptical about morals and ethics, maintaining that good and evil were only concepts that resulted from habit and convention. The followers of Makilikosala were fatalists. They believed that one's lot in life was predetermined and beyond any individual's power to change. If one attained liberation after 500 or 1,000 years of reincarnation, it was due to one's predetermined fate and not to any special efforts. Ajita Kesankabali taught the doctrine of hedonism. He maintained that humans were comprised of the four elements: earth, water, fire, and air. When one died, nothing remained. According to this sect, experience as much pleasure as possible while still alive. The sect headed by Pakuda Kakayana took the opposite view. They believed that one's true soul and body could never be destroyed. They claimed that humans were comprised of seven elements: earth, water, fire, air, suffering, happiness, and life energy. Birth and death were merely outward forms that resulted from the temporary combination and dissolution of the seven elements, while one's true essence was immortal and beyond destruction. Venerables Sariputta and Moggallana had belonged to the sect founded by Sanjaya Belatiputta. Sanjaya taught a doctrine of relativity. He believed that truth changed according to circumstances, time, and place. What was true for one situation might not be true for another. A person's awareness was the measuring rod of all things. Nigantha Nataputta led a sect of ascetics who practiced austerities. They did not wear clothes, and they strictly observed the precept against killing other living beings. Nigantha taught a kind of dualistic fatalism. He believed that two forces, jiva and ajiva, or life and non-life, were the basis of the universe. His sect commanded great respect and influence in the society of the times. The bhikkhus frequently came into contact with Nataputta's ascetics. Both communities shared a common respect for life. But there were many differences between the two communities, and some of Nigantha's followers bitterly opposed the bhikkhus. Venerable Moggallana found the views of the ascetics too extreme, and he did not hesitate to express his opinion. Because of that, many of the ascetics were particularly hostile to Venerable Moggallana. The Buddha returned to Savatthi and stayed in Eastern Park. There was a constant stream of visitors. One morning, Lady Visakha came to see him. Her hair and clothes were drenched with rain. The Buddha asked her, "Visakha, where have you been? Why are your clothes and hair so wet?" Lady Visakha wept. "Lord, my little grandson just died. I wanted to come see you, but in my grief I forgot to take my hat or parasol to protect me from the rain." "How old was your grandson, Visakha? How did he die?" "Lord, he was only 3 years old. He died of typhoid fever." "The poor little one. Visakha, how many children and grandchildren do you have?" "Lord, I have 16 children. 9 are married. I had 8 grandchildren. Now there are only 7. "Visakha, you like having a lot of grandchildren, don't you?" "Oh, yes, Lord. The more the better. Nothing would make me happier than to have as many children and grandchildren as there are people in Savatthi." "Visakha, do you know how many people die each day in Savatthi?" "Lord, sometimes 9 or 10, but at least one person dies every day in Savatthi. There is no day without a death in Savatthi." "Visakha, if your children and grandchildren were as numerous as the people of Savatthi, your hair and clothes would be as soaked as they are today, every day." Visakha joined her palms. "I understand. I really don't want as many children and grandchildren as there are people in Savatthi. The more attachments one has, the more one suffers. You have often taught me this, but I always seem to forget." The Buddha smiled gently. Visakha told him, "Lord, you usually return from your travels only just before the rainy season begins. Your disciples miss you greatly the rest of the year. We come to the monastery, but it seems empty without you. We walk around your hut a few times and then return home, not knowing what else to do." The Buddha said, "Visakha, diligent practice of the teaching is more important than paying visits. When you come to the monastery, you have a chance to listen to other venerables teach the Dharma. You can ask them questions to assist you in your practice. The teaching and the teacher are one. Please don't neglect your practice simply because I am not here." Venerable Ananda, who was standing nearby, proposed an idea. "It would be nice to plant a Bodhi tree here at the monastery. That way, whenever disciples come to visit and you are gone, they could visit the Bodhi tree in your place. They could even bow to it as though bowing to you. We could place a stone altar beneath the tree where disciples could offer flowers. They could walk slowly around the tree while practicing the contemplation of the Buddha." Lady Visakha said, "That is a wonderful idea. But where will you find a Bodhi tree?" Ananda answered, "I can ask for a seed from the Bodhi tree in Uruvela, where the Buddha attained awakening. Don't worry. I will acquire the seed, sprout it, and tend the tree." Lady Visakha felt lighter and comforted. She bowed to the Buddha and to Venerable Ananda, and then returned home. Chapter 61. The Lion's Roar. That same retreat season, Ananda asked a question about dependent co-arising, and so the Buddha taught the bhikkhus about the 12 links in the chain of existence. He explained, "The teaching on dependent co-arising is most profound and subtle. Do not think it can be grasped through words and discourse. Bhikkhus, thanks to hearing the teaching on dependent co-arising, Venerable Uruvela Kassapa entered the path of true Dharma. Venerable Sariputta, another of our most respected brothers, entered the path thanks to hearing a gatha concerning dependent co-arising. Contemplate the nature of dependent co-arising during every moment. When you look at a leaf or a raindrop, meditate on all the conditions, near and distant, that have contributed to the presence of that leaf or raindrop. Know that the world is woven of interconnected threads. This is because that is. This is not because that is not. This is born because that is born. This dies because that dies. The birth and death of any dharma are connected to the birth and death of all other dharmas. The one contains the many, and the many contains the one. Without the one, there cannot be the many. Without the many, there cannot be the one. This is the marvelous truth of the teaching on dependent co-arising. If you look deeply into the nature of all dharmas, you will be able to transcend all anxiety concerning birth and death. You will break through the cycle of birth and death. Because the interconnected links consist of many layers and levels, but 4 realms can be distinguished. Chief causes, contributory causes, the immediately preceding moment as cause, and objects as cause. chief cause is the first condition necessary to give rise to a phenomenon. For example, a grain of rice is the chief cause necessary to give rise to a rice plant. Contributory causes are supportive conditions. In the case of a grain of rice, these include the sun, rain, and earth, which enable the seed to grow into a rice plant. The immediately preceding moment as cause is an uninterrupted process and serves as an underlying cause. Without this continual process, the rice plant's growth would be interrupted before reaching fruition. Objects as cause refer to objects of consciousness. A grain of rice and all the near and distant conditions that make the presence of the rice plant possible are objects of consciousness. They cannot be separated from consciousness. Mind is a basic condition for the existence of all dharmas. Bhikkhus, suffering exists because of the presence of birth and death. What gives rise to birth and death? Ignorance. Birth and death are first of all mental notions. They are the product of ignorance. If you look deeply and penetrate the causes of all things, you will overcome ignorance. Once you have overcome ignorance, you will transcend all thoughts of birth and death. Transcending all thoughts of birth and death, you will overcome all anxieties and sorrows. Because there is the concept of death because there is the concept of birth. These wrong views are based on a false view of the self. There is a false view of the self because there is grasping. There is grasping because there is desire. There is desire because one does not see into the true nature of feelings. One does not see into the true nature of feelings because one is caught up in the contact that takes place between the sense organs and their objects. One is caught up in the contact that takes place between the sense organs and their objects because one's mind is not clear and calm. One's mind is not clear and calm because there are drives and impulses. These drives and impulses are due to ignorance. These 12 links of the chain of existence are connected to each other. In each link, you can see the other 11 links. If one link is missing, the other 11 will be missing. These 12 links are death, birth, becoming, grasping, craving, feelings, contact, the 6 sense organs, name and form, consciousness, drives and impulses, and ignorance. Because ignorance underlies all 12 links of the chain of existence. Thanks to the contemplation on the nature of dependent co-arising, we can dispel ignorance in order to transcend all anxieties and sorrows. An enlightened person walks over the waves of birth and death and does not drown in them. An enlightened person uses the 12 links of the chain of existence like the wheels of a carriage. An enlightened person lives in the very midst of the world, but is never submerged by it. Bhikkhus, do not try to run away from birth and death. You need only rise above them. Transcending birth and death is the attainment of great beings. In a Dharma discussion several days later, Venerable Mahakasapa reminded the community that the Buddha had given the teaching on dependent co-arising many times in the past, and that this teaching could be considered the heart of the way of awakening. He reminded the community that the Buddha had once used a bunch of reeds to illustrate the teaching on dependent co-arising. The Lord had said that things do not need a creator, that they arise from one another. Ignorance causes drives and impulses, and drives and impulses cause ignorance, just as reeds lean on one another to stand. And if one reed falls, the other reeds also fall. This is true of all things in the universe. The one creates the many, and the many the one. If we look deeply, we can see the one in the many, and the many in the one. During that same retreat season, several Brahmins conspired to falsely accuse the Buddha of sleeping with a woman and making her pregnant. They found an attractive young Brahmana woman named Chinka and told her that the Buddha had caused a rapid decline in the faith of their ancestors by luring many young men to become his disciples. Anxious to protect her faith, Chinka agreed to the plan. Every day she went to Jetavana dressed in a beautiful sari and carrying a fresh bouquet of flowers. She did not arrive in time for the Dharma talks, but waited outside the Dharma hall as people left to return home. At first, whenever anyone asked her where she was going or what she was doing, she only smiled. After several days, she answered coyly, "I'm going where I'm going." After several weeks of such vague comments, she began to answer, "I'm going to visit Monk Gautama." And finally, she was heard to exclaim, "Sleeping at Jetavana is delightful." Such words burned the ears of many people. Some lay people began to feel doubts and suspicions, but no one said anything. One day, Chinka came to one of the Buddha's Dharma talks. Her belly was noticeably round. In the middle of the Buddha's discourse, she stood up and loudly said, "Teacher Gautama, you speak eloquently about the Dharma. You are held in high esteem, but you care nothing for this poor woman made pregnant by you. The child I carry is your own. Are you going to take responsibility for your own child?" A wave of shock passed through the community. Everyone looked up at the Buddha. The Buddha only smiled calmly and replied, "Miss, only you and I can know whether or not your claims are true." The Buddha's calm smile made Chinka feel uneasy, but she retorted, "That's right, only you and I know whether my claims are true." The community could no longer suppress their astonishment. Several people stood up in anger. Chinka suddenly felt afraid the people would beat her. She looked for a way to escape, but in her panic, she ran into a post and stumbled. As she strained to stand back up, a large round block of wood fell from where it was tied onto her abdomen and landed on her foot. She cried out in pain and grabbed her crushed toes. Her stomach was now perfectly flat. A sigh of relief rose from the crowd. Several people began laughing, and others derided Chinka. Bhikkhuni Khema stood up and gently assisted Chinka out of the hall. When the two women were gone, the Buddha resumed his Dharma talk as if nothing had happened. The Buddha spoke, "Community, the way of enlightenment can tear down the walls of ignorance just as light can disperse the shadows. The Four Noble Truths, impermanence, non-self, dependent co-arising, the four establishments of mindfulness, the seven factors of awakening, the three gates and the Noble Eightfold Path have all been proclaimed to the world like a lion's roar, dispelling countless false doctrines and narrow views. The lion is king of the beasts. When he leaves his den, he stretches and gazes out over all the directions. Before seeking his prey, he lets forth a mighty roar that causes the other creatures to tremble and flee. Birds fly high, crocodiles dive beneath the water, foxes slip into their holes, even village elephants, decked in fancy belts and ornaments and shaded by golden parasols, run away at the sound of that roar. Community, the proclamation of the way of enlightenment is like that lion's roar. False doctrines fear and tremble. When impermanence, non-self, and dependent co-arising are proclaimed, all those who have long sought false security in ignorance and forgetfulness must awaken, celestial beings as well as human beings. When a person sees the dazzling truth, he exclaims, 'We embraced dangerous views for so long, taking the impermanent to be permanent and believing in the existence of a separate self. We took suffering to be pleasure and look at the temporary as if it were eternal. We mistook the false for the true. Now the time has come to tear down all the walls of forgetfulness and false views. Community, the way of enlightenment allows humanity to remove the thick veil of false views. When an enlightened person appears, the way echoes like the majestic sound of the rising tide. When the tide rises, all false views are swept away. Community, people are easily caught by four traps. The first is attachment to sensual desires. The second is attachment to narrow views. The third is doubt and suspicion. The fourth is false view of self. The way of enlightenment helps people overcome the four great traps. Community, the teaching on dependent co-arising will enable you to overcome every obstacle and trap. Contemplate the nature of interdependence in your daily life, in your body, feelings, mind, and objects of mind." The next day in the main hall, Ananda repeated the Buddha's Dharma talk. He named it Sutra of the Lion's Roar. That retreat season, many bhikkhus fell ill with malaria. Many grew thin and pale and no longer had the strength to go out begging for themselves. Other bhikkhus readily shared their food with them, but much of the food contained rice and curry, which was too harsh on the stomachs of the sick. The Buddha gave permission to lay disciples to prepare special dishes for the sick bhikkhus. They cooked food that was easily digested, such as rice porridge with wholesome ingredients like honey, milk, cane sugar, and oil. Thanks to these foods, the bhikkhus slowly regained their health. One day, after sitting meditation, The Buddha heard the squawking of a great number of crows. When he went to investigate, he found a number of bhikkhus tossing the special foods prepared for the sick bhikkhus to the crows. They explained that a number of brothers had felt too ill to eat that morning. The hour of noon had passed, and the bhikkhus were not to partake of food after noon. When the Buddha asked why they didn't save the special foods for the following day, he was reminded that food was not to be kept overnight. The Buddha told them that sick bhikkhus could be relieved of the precept not to eat anything after the noon hour, and if certain foods would keep, they could be saved overnight. Not long after, a physician from the capital paid a visit to the Venerable Sariputta. He suggested that sick bhikkhus be served a dish of special herbs and ingredients. Thanks to that, the bhikkhus regained their health more quickly.